Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. All right, good morning. It's Sunday, the 7th of June, 2009. That makes this Solder Smoke 109. Hey, and I hope everybody's been having a good early part of the summer here. I got some travelogue to open up. Some Italian travelogue, but some Dutch travelogue. I was up in Holland last weekend. First time I've ever been to that country. What a wonderful place. I was in Rotterdam. Billy plays in an orchestra in his school, and once a year the orchestra gets to take a trip to some place foreign. And this year it was to the Netherlands, and we went up there and with the orchestra. With Billy's class, and it was a lot of fun. I didn't get to do anything related to ham radio there. It was completely focused on the kids and the trip and the music. And but what a great trip, and what an interesting, nice country. People were really, really very kind to us. The flight up was easy and beautiful. It was a clear day. Flew up along the west coast of Italy, up over Genoa, then up over Torino, over Turin, across the Alps, and then right on over to the Netherlands. And a really, really interesting place. What a technologically interesting country. And we were in at one point in the town of Delft. Really amazing place, the home of the inventor of the microscope. And many other really notable people, of course, also. But while we were there, they told us that we were about 6 feet below sea level. And I told Billy, I said, you know, people, to live in that kind of environment, to live at that altitude, a group of people really needs to have their act together technologically. So anyway, it was a great trip, and we really enjoyed it, as a New Yorker, it was also interesting too, because you know, as you go around the Netherlands, you run into so many place names that are familiar to someone who's from what used to be known as New Amsterdam. So it was a very interesting trip, and if you have a chance to go to Holland, I strongly recommend it. Now, some Italian travelogue. On the 2nd of June. 2nd of June is sort of the Italian equivalent of our 4th of July. It's the national day. It commemorates the day in 1946 in which the Italians held elections and decided to create a republic. And this is celebrated in Rome with a big military parade. And it's right across the Tiber River from where we live. So at the appointed hour, we all headed over and got a good spot on the parade route. Our spot was right next to Capitoline Hill. Those of you who've been to Rome, this is the big flight of stairs that goes up into the piazza designed by Michelangelo, with all kinds of amazing art. Right on the other side of the hill is the Roman Forum, and the Victor Emmanuel Monument, the more modern monument to King Victor Emmanuel, is there also. So it's pretty much the heart of Rome. We were right next to Piazza Venezia, which many people consider to be the real heart of Rome. We had a great spot on the parade route, and the parade was mostly Italian military, but other countries participated. NATO countries participated, and I was proud to see a company of American paratroopers participating in the parade. I have to say, though, you know, I really, to be honest, the best marchers in the entire parade were the Italian army guys. I mean, it has to do with kind of the national talent for doing things with panache. That's the way to do it. The way to say it with brio. The Italians, they can really put on a good show in this kind of with this kind of thing. We really enjoyed watching the Italian units go marching by because they did it with real enthusiasm. You know, sometimes I've been in many. When I was in the Army, I was in a lot of parades. Well, not a lot, but a few. You kind of get through it. You know, but when the Italian companies and battalions would come by, they'd be running and stomping their feet and singing, and I mean not just the same old, you know, marching songs that they sing in other places, but really good songs. So hats off to the Italian military on their 2nd of June parade here in Rome. It was a lot of fun. Also, it was a lot of fun. The crowd was very nice. I mean, people, there's a lot of kindness here. And you know, in other places, if you go to a big parade like this, there's a lot of struggling and elbow jabbing as people try to get a good spot to see. But we showed up, and a few of the folks that had good spots there saw Billy and Maria trying to peek out from behind the adults, and they immediately made space for them and put the kids up there up front. Very very kind thing to do, and typical of the kind of treatment that you receive here in Italy. People are generally nice, but they're super nice to you if you have small kids. So hats off to the Italians for that also. All right, back to radio. You know, while I was up in Rotterdam, at one point, I guess it was on the plane on the way up, I started thinking about Class C amplifiers, as you do. And I started thinking about the formula that's used to tell you what particular load value you should put on the Class C amplifier for a specific desired level of power out. It's the same formula that you could use to determine what the power out, what the maximum power out could be for a given collector voltage and load. And the formula is often stated as power out equals VCC minus VE squared over 2 RL. That's right. PO equals VCC minus VE squared over 2 PO. And of course you could substitute PO and RL, and you could determine one or the other. But basically it's a formula, a very familiar formula, one of the basic formulas for amplifier design. What got me thinking about it was this article that I've been talking about in the Atlanticon 2002 QRP forum. It's by Paul Hardin, NA5N. Yeah, I'm just thumbing through it right now. Make sure I got everything right here. Yeah. And Paul wrote this article back in 2002, and I've been talking it up. I really like it, and it's very kind of down to earth, very very real world, and it gives you a lot of real. It's called The Handyman's Guide to QRP Transmitters: Basic Transmitter Theory Using 50-Ohm Mixers, Driver Design, and Output Filter Designs. I don't think it's... We checked. We thought at one point that it might be on Paul's very fine business website, but it's not there. So I've been going back and forth with Paul on email, and I hope that someday soon we're able to get this fine article into wider circulation. But anyway... Paul's article got me thinking about this. I had been thinking about this formula back when I was studying and trying to understand Class A amplifiers. And the formula kind of bothered me because I'd been using it for years, and I really didn't know why we used this formula. What was behind it? What was the logic behind it? For me... Now, this formula was sort of a mathematical black box. You know, we don't like the use of black boxes in radio. We like to know what's going on, how the box works, whether the box be a transceiver or an any 602 chip. You know, if it's the more mystery that's there, the more of it's a little more black boxish it is, I think the more uncomfortable we feel as true diehard radical fundamentalist homebrewers. So anyway, when I come across one of these formulas where they just say, well, here it is, and that's what it is, and if you want to know what the load is, you plug it in there and that'll give it to you. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, why do we do that? Why would you take the collector voltage, subtract the emitter voltage, square it, and then divide it by 2 times the power output that you want? Where does that come from? Anyway, this is one of the kind of technical issues, technical sort of mathematical electronic issues that I take up in the book, Solder Smoke, A Global Adventure in Radio Electronics. From time to time in the book, I stop describing radio adventures in various places around the world and what I did as a ham radio operator as a kid, and I focus on a technical issue, a question, something that bothered me somewhere in my experience as a radio amateur, something that I was trying to figure out and had a hard time figuring out. Okay, so anyway, I managed to figure out this formula. I really figured it out for Class A amplifiers to my satisfaction, and I said, okay, well, then for me, it's no longer a mathematical black box. I understand this formula, and I was very satisfied. But then when I read Paul's article, I noticed that he was describing Class C amplifiers, but he said that we could use the same formula. And that really started to be scratching my head as I flew up to Holland, because when you think about it, you know, we've always been taught about what the waveforms look like coming out of a Class A amplifier. It's supposed to be linear. It's supposed to be a more energetic or powerful reproduction of the input. But the Class C amplifier is different. You know, you get the familiar waveform at the output, which just looks like a series of pulses, because the transistor only conducts when the base voltage rises above the 0.6% threshold voltage for the base emitter junction. When the input signal is below that 0.6 level, basically there's no current flowing in the collector circuit. So you set it up so that when that input voltage comes along, the transistor only conducts during the peaks when the voltage at the input goes above that 0.6 or 0.7 volt threshold. So at the output, you know, we're used to seeing since novice days the output that shows a bunch of little bumps, well, hopefully bigger bumps, in the collector circuit during those portions of the input signal cycle in which the voltage is of sufficient level to get the transistor to conduct. You guys, you get my drift. You've seen these kind of diagrams. Well, so this made me wonder, why could we use exactly the same formula for Class A amplifiers with their nice linear full cycle reproduction of the input signal? Why could we use that with Class C amplifiers? Why? Look, if these are the kind of questions that keep you up at night, Solder Smoke is the podcast for you, and Solder Smoke, the book, is the book for you, because these are the kind of issues that bother us. Other people worry about other things. We worry about why can you apply this formula to Class C amplifiers in addition to being able to use it with those nice, pretty linear Class A amplifiers. All right, so I started thinking. And then I do what I do at this point, and that is I turn to the library. And, of course, I turn to the old standbys, experimental methods in RF design, and the older standby, solid-state design for radio amateurs. And I found, and I also, at the same time, fire up LT Spice. Some wise man said a while back that EMRFD, SSDRA, LT Spice are together, perhaps with some help from QRPL, kind of a BSEE in a can. Well, I opened up the can. Wes and I, from time to time, exchange emails about EMRFD or SSDRA. He's an author of both of them, and he has often told me that everything that's in SSDRA is in EMRFD, and I believe him, of course. This usually comes up because periodically there's somebody saying, hey, why don't we launch another effort to get SSDRA published again? And at that point, whenever this comes up, Wes points out that the idea behind EMRFD was to get all the information from the old book into the new book, updated and even better. And it certainly does that. But, you know, I've told Wes, and I think other people have said this too, that for some reason, every once in a while, on some issue, EMRFD, the older book, Solid State Design, seems to explain something in a way that may be more understandable to us, the great electronics unwashed, the layman out here, who are not professional electronics engineers. I'm not saying that EMRFD doesn't do that. EMRFD is certainly targeted at the same group, the true amateurs at being radio amateurs. But for some reason, when I turn to EMRFD, sometimes I find myself thinking, well, let me go back and take a look at the older book. And that's what happened in this case. And I did. And I found the answer to my question pretty easily in let me see if I can find the page here. Class C power amplifiers on page 24. I think that's it. Let me see. Let's see. Da, 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 da. Yeah, here it is. I'm looking at it, and my question was, okay, how if we have this sort of bumpy, you know, just at the peaks conduction situation in the transistor, why are we using the same formula that we use for Class A amplifiers? And here's the line. This is the line that solved it for me. Okay, if we assume that the collector voltage varies from zero to twice the VCC level while delivering the desired output power, the load needed at the collector of the Class C amplifier is given by the familiar relation R sub L equals VCC squared divided by 2 times the power output. There, that's the thing. If we assume that the collector voltage varies from zero to twice the VCC level. Now, what I was thinking was that the voltage there at the collector was going from the VCC level down to zero on these peaks, because when the voltage, assuming we have an NPN transistor, when that voltage on the base goes up above the 0.6 volts, the transistor starts to conduct, and the voltage there on the collector drops and could drop down to zero if you bring it down, if you bring the transistor to saturation, or down to zero, or down to near zero, or down to whatever the value of VCC minus VE is. This is kind of hard to describe without diagrams in front of you, but I have something on this up on the Blogspot page. You'll see what I'm talking about, because I just posted a screenshot from my adventures in LT Spice. What I did then with LT Spice, to see what was going on here, I built a little very rudimentary Class C amplifier in LT Spice, and I started looking at input and output waveforms, and I started seeing what I had to do to produce the kind of waveform described in SSDRA. And the key, of course, here is the inductor, the inductance in the collector circuit, because as with a Class A amplifier, you get in a Class A amplifier, you know, if you're running it with a transformer or an RF choke, in the output circuit, you could set up a situation in which the voltage in the collector circuit goes from the VCC value, from the supply value, down to zero, and then up to twice the VCC value. That's a pretty neat trick, a pretty useful trick. And when I was trying to understand Class A amps, I said, how do they do that? You've got 12 volts, you've got a 12-volt power supply, but on the collector of the Class A amplifier, you have output waveforms going up to 22, 24 volts. How's that happening? And what it is it's the energy stored in the inductor, and it puts the additional voltage into the circuit and allows you to have that kind of voltage in the output circuit. Okay, so I started thinking, how does this work with a Class C amplifier? Well, the same thing is going on when that input waveform gets to the point where the current in the collector circuit is cut off. When it drops below the 0.6 volt value, when the input signal gets below that value, the transistor cuts off and the voltage at the collector goes back to the VCC level, but goes beyond it because the energy that's been stored in that transformer or that RF choke is then dumped onto the collector, and then that's how you get a voltage in the collector circuit that could go up to twice the VCC level. And that's how you get the assumption that's behind the use of this formula. The assumption being is, if we assume that the collector voltage varies from zero to twice the VCC level, that's the key assumption. Anyway, I came to understand this by looking at the three books and at Paul's article, which prompted the whole head scratching episode, and LT Spice. One of the interesting things is, if take a look at the waveform that you get on when you do this on LT Spice. This is without any kind of low pass filter at the output. This is without the low pass filter. Just to illustrate what the waveform would look like if you didn't use a low pass filter in this kind of amplifier. And believe me, the waveform is ugly and obviously filled with harmonics and other nasties in there. So this was for me a good way of seeing very clearly why the requirement to use a low pass filter in the output of a Class C amplifier is very good advice indeed. So anyway, these are the things that keep us up at night. Anyway, I kind of enjoyed going through this little exercise, and I hope I've not hopelessly jumbled it up here, and I hope I've made it somewhat understandable. Again, these are the kind of things that we take up in the understanding portions of the Solder Smoke book. All right, looking back at the blog, some of the other things that came up this week. Also, something came from Paul, NA5N, another thing that Paul talked about, radio signals from Jupiter. You know, Paul works out there at the Very Large Array, the VLA. Talk about a guy who's got the dream ham radio job. I think Paul's got it. Working out at the VLA, this is the antenna system out there in New Mexico that was featured in the movie Contact, based on the book by Carl Sagan. You know, Jodie Foster out there in the desert with her headphones on, big antennas, all those big dishes pointed out there at some star that's sending us a signal. Paul, on Paul's website, he has a picture of his wife with a QRP rig with the headphones on, with a kind of Jodie Foster-ish kind of baseball cap, but apparently she was listening to 20 meter CW and not some star out there sending us a signal from ET. But Paul, there was a message. I think there was a series of emails on QRPL. A guy had written in about looking for some simple radio astronomy projects that he could use. He was trying to do something with high school kids, I think, and he was looking for advice on simple radio astronomy projects. And people suggested listening to the radio signals from Jupiter. Now, Jupiter emits radio signals in what we call the HF frequency bands, 17 to 20 megahertz. You could hear them here on planet Earth. They're natural emissions, of course. It's kind of interesting that they come to us on the HF band, just in the 17 meter frequency range there. I didn't know that they're related to the position of Jupiter's moon Io, one of the four Galilean moons. Now, I've had my telescope out and aimed at Jupiter, and I've looked at Io many times. And you could watch it go around Jupiter, go behind Jupiter, go in front of Jupiter, even with a very relatively small scope like my 6-inch Dobsonian reflector. And I had heard before of the signals from Jupiter, but I never really understood that they were related to the position of Io, and which made it all somehow much more interesting to me. This is something that we could, you know, there are actual calculators and charts out there that will allow you to determine, well, here's where Io is, and let's see if this is a good time to listen for the radio signals from Jupiter. Apparently, you don't need much of a directional antenna, but a bit of directivity helps. And if you know what you're listening to when you get it set up properly, and if Io is in the proper position, then you can hear signals from Jupiter. Apparently, they sound like waves slowly crashing on the beach. It all sounds very neat. I put information up on this with links to, I think, excerpts from Paul's emails and some links to some relevant websites. I also found a really cool NASA photo of Jupiter and Io. It's kind of a false color composite image, but it looks really, I thought it looked really good. So I got it up there on the blog. Check that out. I think you'll find this very interesting, and who knows, you guys might be listening direct to signals from Jupiter. It doesn't seem too difficult, and it seems like it'd be some really good DX, you know what I mean? All right, let's see. What else are we going to talk about here? Oh, as long as I'm talking about the blog, let me talk about some other stuff that I've had on there. I don't want to create the impression that I've gone into summer reruns on the blog. What happened was when I started the soldersmoke.blogspot.com blog, the Solder Smoke News, later Solder Smoke Daily News, I had an earlier blog called Gadgeteer News that I thought had a lot of good stuff on it. So I just dumped that and made that sort of the initial blog entry, the new blog, dumped it kind of in mass onto the blog page, and then went on from there. But recently I've been working on the index for the blog, because I've noticed that as you get a lot of blog entries in there, it's useful to have a good index so people can take a look there and, well, do what you do with an index or a table of contents and go to those particular entries or articles that are of interest. The old articles weren't included in the index, so what I've been doing is going back and finding some old articles that and taking them out and sort of rerunning them. Some of them are back from 2006. One of them I found was KK7B's Thoughts on Minimalist Radio. KK7B is, of course, Rick Campbell, one of the authors of Experimental Methods in RF Design. And a while back on, I think, QRPL, I think it was on the EMRFD mailing list, he had a very thoughtful article on minimalist radio. And we've been discussing this and working on minimalist rigs. I thought Rick's observations on this were really interesting. So I posted a rerun of his posting there, and that's up on the blog this week. Also with a picture taken by Roger Hayward of a toroid winding contest at the, I think it was the 2007 FDIM event. And we got a picture there of Rick winning the contest. I understand he was the champ toroid winder. Steve Smith, our man out there in Oxnard, the snort rosin solder smoke aroma aficionado, wrote in and saying that this is a toroid winding contest. Seems to be you know, evidence of kind of masochistic tendencies among radio amateur homebrewers. But all I can say, Steve, is that, well, you're the snort rosin guy, so I wouldn't really be, you know, talking about other people's masochistic tendencies. As a matter of fact, I've been reading your mail there, Steve, and I'm thinking there must be a 12-step program out there for you. We'll try to get you some help, old man. What else we have on the blog? talking about somebody who might need a 12-step program. Our man down there in Australia, Alan Yates, VK2ZAY, who is considered by some to be kind of an Australian version of Michael, AA1TJ. Alan down there, I check his website, I check his blog every once in a while. I think you all should. It's very interesting. Some of his latest adventures have gotten him into the extremely high-frequency bands. I mean, really, really, really ultra super high frequencies. We're talking X-rays here, guys. Alan, VK2ZAY, has discovered, or I don't know if he discovered it himself, but has made use of the fact that old 2X2 rectifier tubes, if fed with an ungodly amount of voltage, can be made to emit X-rays. And of course, Alan had to do this, so he's down there emitting X-rays in his shack. And of course, it's a good thing that his previous project was to build a Geiger counter. So first he builds the Geiger counter, and apparently the Geiger counter will click when confronted with X-rays. And then he builds the 2X2 rectifier tube X-ray emitter device. And he's sitting there in the shack emitting X-rays, and I read his article, and he did some what seemed to me kind of back of the envelope calculations about how much X-ray energy he himself was absorbing as he played these as he did these fascinating experiments. It all reminded me of an article in the old book, The Amateur Scientist, by C.L. Strong. And build an amateur X-ray machine, and they had all kinds of pictures of people taking X-rays of their own hands and dead fish and all this other stuff. Probably, today, I don't know if in the current litigation environment, certainly in the United States, I don't know if this thing would be allowed. You'd probably have Homeland Security kicking down the door too, suddenly detecting large amounts of X-ray radiation coming from your third-floor apartment. Could raise some eyebrows somewhere. But anyway, that's another thing that's on the blog. You'll see we have a picture of Alan and a trip down memory lane. Remember those X-ray specs in the back of the magazine, guys? You'll remember, you know, you're looking there through Popular Science or Popular Electronics magazine as a teenager, and all of a sudden you'd see this advertisement in the back for glasses that promise to allow you to have X-ray vision. Wow. X-ray vision. That's what guys want when they're... One of the things that guys want when they're 13 or 14 years old. Anyway, Alan's article made me think about this, and I dug up the advertisements through the miracle of Google's image search, and I have it there. So check that out. Also on the... on the blog, another website that I go back and check every once in a while, it's the website of Jeff Dam, WA7MLH. Jeff is a really amazing radio amateur. Got many other interests, too. They're all on his website also. But he is one of the guys that built the circuits that are displayed in Solid State Design for the Radio Amateur. And just an amazing home brewer, and I always say that some of Jeff's creations that appear in SSDRA helped liberate us from the tyranny of neatness and right angles. You know, some of the other ARRL books that are out there, they emphasized really neat circuits, and you'd look at them, and you know, especially the tube type circuits, and man, everything was just so neat. It looked like it'd come out of a NASA clean room. Every resistor had the lead just precisely turned at a 90-degree angle. The soldering was impeccable. There were no solder blobs anywhere. Everything looked like it had been measured several times and cut only once. There were no extra holes in the chassis. Gosh, you know, I never thought I could build anything that looked like that. But when I looked at the pictures in SSDRA and I saw some of the work in there, I said, well, that's something that I can build. It looks like circuits that have been built by real radio amateurs and real human beings. And anyway, I went back to Jeff's site, and he has on there this amazing picture of him in his shack circa 1988. And for some reason, that picture seems to capture for me the true spirit of the real radio amateur home brewer. There's an intensity in Jeff's look, in the look on his face. There's an intensity. You look in his eyes, he looks like he'd been up late at night the night before trying to get that circuit working. And he's got that look like, yeah, this thing's working now. And then you look on his bench there. Actually, he's at the operating position. And you see it's almost entirely homebrew. All these great-looking homebrew rigs there. All of them look like they're connected to antennas and ready to emit CW and SSB radio waves. And then you look on the table, and what does he have in front of him? There it is, solid-state design for the radio amateur. Anyway, I put this picture up there. I hope Jeff doesn't mind it. And I put a link to his website. I hope this will bring people to the website. But I really thought it was a great picture, and that's why I put it up there. All right, going to shift gears a little bit here, talk a little bit about books, specifically starting out here with the book Solder Smoke, A Global Adventure in Radio Electronics. It's doing quite well. I'm very pleased. I seem to be getting a lot of good feedback. It's being read all over the world. I know somebody in Paris is reading it. It's being read in Australia. It's being read all over the United States. Being read in the UK. I was particularly pleased to get email from the UK indicating that delivery in that country is really, really fast. Somebody wrote in, and I don't have his call in front of me. I missed this one because I read it on my BlackBerry up in Rotterdam. But a fellow from the UK wrote in and told me that he placed his order on the lulu.com website on Tuesday, and I think he said he got the book on Thursday in the UK. Now that's pretty good. Or at least it was dispatched on Thursday. Maybe he got it on Thursday, but Tuesday to Thursday. Anyway, he was amazed at the speed with which this book was brought to his home. The reason is that the company that's printing it, Lulu, is a really good company, and they make use of printing plants not only in the U.S., but also they have a printing plant in the U.K. So for U.K. listeners who are interested in the book, don't think you have to go through some extraordinarily difficult process of getting it from the United States through customs and all that. No. You can order it. And apparently they'll print it up right there in the United Kingdom and send it to you. I also understand they have a printing plant in continental Europe, in Spain, I believe. So anyway, you can get this book pretty much no matter where you are. I know it's been delivered to folks in Australia, and like I said, delivery times to the UK and Europe are apparently pretty fast. What I'm going to do to give people a better idea what the book's all about, I'm going to post probably later today the table of contents. I'll put it up there on the blog so you can see what more about what the book is about. In terms of the technical content of the book, the kind of issue that I discussed before, the Class C amps and the power out formula, that's, I think, pretty typical of the kind of technical discussions that I get into. These may not be the kind of issues that cause you to scratch your particular head as you tried to understand this stuff. But I hope that kind of the approach that I take to trying to figure these things out is interesting and helpful for you. Again, this is the kind of book that I wrote. I wanted to write a book that would be fun to read. It wouldn't be kind of a chore to read. And that would be the kind of book that you'd be happy to stick under your arm as you head off to the beach this summer, because it'll be both fun and hopefully technically rewarding. The idea is that after you finish reading this book, that you may have a better understanding not only of all my hopefully funny stories and anecdotes as about putting up antennas above my parents' house in Congers, New York in 1977, and doing the same thing later in London and the Azores and other places, but also that you'll come away from the reading with a bit of a better understanding of some of the what I found to be the more difficult technical issues. For example, mixers. I do quite a bit on mixers in this book. Why and how do mixers mix? Why is it that we say that mixers are multipliers, but they produce some and difference frequencies? And how is it that by multiplying signals together, you end up with some and difference frequencies? And how is it, by the way, that a simple diode can perform multiplication? Why does that work? And why is it that you need a nonlinear device to produce the sum and difference frequencies? These are the kind of issues that keep us up at night. Anyway, I hope you'll get the book and enjoy it, and I hope you'll send back some feedback. If you're enjoying it, please let other radio amateurs know about it. And anyway, I hope it leads to a discussion of some of the topics discussed in the book. Let's see. Okay. More printed material. This is another thing that I have mentioned up on the blog. This one's a lot of fun. You know, I've mentioned from time to time Tim Walford's kit company and his Constructors Club and the Journal of the Constructors Club, a fine publication called Hot Iron. Tim has very kindly been sending me these the copies of Hot Iron, and I really like it. And it's a lot of fun. It's kind of got the same friendly tone to it that Spratt has. I mean, I don't think anything can rival Spratt, and I'm sure Tim would agree with that. But Hot Iron is in the running. It's in the same kind of category. It's at the same kind of technical level. It's really, really good. And the summer 2009 issue 64, is, I think, one of the best issues that I've seen. It's Tim opens up with an editorial about life on his farm and how sometimes duties on the farm can distract from radio design and kit preparation and kit construction. And there's discussion of recent kit developments. But then I think my favorite part of this edition is a column written by Richard Booth, G0TTL. The column is called Doodles from Doncaster. And Richard really, really gets into some interesting stuff here. I hope Tim and Richard don't mind me giving a little bit of a preview of what's in here. But, you know, over the years we've discussed how different items available in the kitchen and often in the bathroom can be used in the construction of amateur radio equipment. Mike and I, KL7R and I, really had a good time in, I think, several episodes way back discussing the use of desitin as a heat sink compound. Desitin is a kind of baby lotion that's used to deal with the scourge of diaper rash. 10 years or so ago, I was dealing with this myself. Not for me, but for my kids, of course. Anyway, we had Desitin around the house, and I still probably had some of it at that point. And I think it was Mike who discovered that you could use this as kind of a cheap heat sink compound. And it would result in kind of a pleasant odor. There was a side benefit there. It kind of smelled good. And of course, there's been all kinds of different compounds that could be used to seal up the, or to make the wire turns on a toroidal inductor stay where they're supposed to stay and all that stuff. Here's a new one, though. In Doodles from Doncaster, Richard G0TTL reports that Andy Howgate, G7WHM, has come up with a cheap alternative to PCB lacquer. What they're using is floor polish. No ordinary floor polish, though, writes Richard. This stuff is called Clear, K-L-E-A-R. It's intended for wooden floors and is manufactured by Johnson & Johnson. One coat wiped over the PCB with a soft cloth is ample. And having now used it, I will never buy another can of proper PCB lacquer. Holy cow. There you go. Clear. Floor polish. Johnson & Johnson. Used for PCB lacquer. This is the kind of stuff that you get if you subscribe to Hot Iron. Anyway, Richard then goes on to describe some software that can be used for schematic diagram drawing and PCB design. He notes that all QRPers should have a magnetic loop antenna. And then, gentlemen, he gets to a part of the article that I think is somewhat suspiciously prophetic. You'll see what I mean here in a second. This part of the article is entitled Interesting Signals. This is a very kind of understated British way. When they say interesting, they mean like really, 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 really interesting. Americans would be more, I think, exuberant, expressive. There's this kind of calm, stiff upper lip, understated British thing here. And with the way Richard describes what he terms interesting signals. It says here, after living here 10 years, I finally installed a few antenna feeds into my office. I was wondering what transmissions are about on HF apart from broadcast, volant, and amateur signals. I was very pleasantly surprised. Ever since the good old days of the Cold War, I've been fascinated by signals that we are not supposed to hear. I thought all this sort of thing had gone digital or transponded by satellite, and I had not listened away from the established bands. Happily, that is not the case. And a tune around 4 megahertz during the late evening yielded many things of interest. There are a lot of analog HF still in use for shipping, espionage, yes, even number station beacons, etc., etc. Anyway, he gets into a discussion here of the old numbers stations. These are the stations, you know what I'm talking about, a voice there, sometimes in Spanish, sometimes in English, sometimes male, sometimes female, just droning on. 5, 6, 8, 7, 2, 1, on and on and on and on. Obviously something of the encrypted nature being discussed there. Richard closes his article there by saying, I could fill a whole edition of Hot Iron with times and frequencies, but have a listen yourself. They are there. Until we meet again, signed Agent 00X. Yes, 00X. You know, I read that article, and the next day, we don't want to get into this too much here, but the next day, I opened up my Yahoo News or Google News and saw the story currently in the papers, in today's papers, out of Washington, D.C., regarding an episode of espionage. And in the episode of espionage, you'll see in the articles they make frequent mention of the use of shortwave radio. anyway, check out the news articles. You'll see what I mean. And again, Richard, and Tim, I think it very, very, shall we say, interesting that your fine magazine has this article about the use of shortwave and espionage, and that the article came out just days before the real thing hit the newspapers. Anyway, check it out. I took a picture of Tim's workbench, the workbench that produces all these fine kits from out there in Somerset. I put it up on the blogspot.com, soldersmoke.blogspot.com page, also with a list of Tim's kits and a description of each of the kits. I really like the kit names. They're great, and also they're the kind of kits that we're interested in. There are some regen receiver kits in there. There are actually double sideband kits in there, kits for double sideband rigs. Check them out. I think you'll really like them. I think they're all very nice, and I hope you enjoy the look at Tim's very fine web page. I'm a very, very fine workbench there. All right, gentlemen, it's time for
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
Indeed. Yeah, Solder Smoke Mailbag. One thing that I meant to include in our report from FDIM, in our report from 4 days in May, there was an additional recording there, and it was a very nice recording in Italian from I2TRF. So I2TRF, if you're listening, I got it. I'm going to try to work it into a future show. It's in Italian, so I'll just do an excerpt to let people hear it a little bit. But I've been having some computer problems here, and I'll try to get it up there. Grazie mille, and thanks very much for the nice, kind words there. Continuing on here in Mailbag, Frank, VK2AKG, I guess this is appropriate for the folks who might be in need of a 12-step program related to radioactivity. Frank points out an article in Harper's Magazine from about 10 years ago, I think now, on the radioactive Boy Scout. We talked about this way back, I think, in the early days of Solder Smoke, and it's about some kid in, I think it was in the D.C. area or Maryland, who got into radioactivity and created a kind of a major kind of radioactive hazmat situation there in his suburban neighborhood. A lot of fun. If you're interested, just Google radioactive Boy Scout. You'll find the article. Mark Z, K-N-9-O-O-I, is reading the book. He's reading Solder Smoke, the book, and is working on a HAL, H-A-L, communication terminal. I had been looking through an old issue of Ham Radio Magazine and saw the ads in the back there for the HAL terminals, and Mark's got one, is working on it. Good luck with that. The news article that I talked about provoked some email exchanges on QRPL. I think that the title was pretty clever, "The Spy Who Worked Me." Reference to the use of shortwave, and one of the messages there from KD9JYK provides a number of good links to websites about these number stations. I'll try to get those links up onto the blog. Alan W2AEW, our intrepid Tektronix RF application engineer, also has the book. And apparently it's traveling around the Northeast with him. I wrote him a note. I said, no reading while driving, Alan, but I do hope you get a chance to read the book during your travels. Let me know what you think. Richard, G3ZTB, has been in Rome recently, took some nice pictures. I'll try to get them up to give a bit of a visual travelogue. He also points out that there's available on the web what's known as a Morse code translator. People became aware of this, I think, when Google used Morse during the birthday of Samuel F.B. Morse. Richard is pleased that Whisper and QRSS seem to be catching on and seem to be leading to a bit of a resurgence in homebrew interest. Eric, SM6RXZ, is reading NA5N's Atlanticon article, The Handyman's Guide, and I hope to have some exchange of views with Eric on that. And we do, like I said, we hope to get wider circulation for that article soon so that we can all kind of take a look at it and hopefully discuss it a bit. Jim, AL7RV, is now up near Lake Michigan, and he has access to a workbench in a shed and will be melting solder. In the meantime, he continues to whispering off of an Outbacker. An Outbacker antenna out in the backyard, and he's emitting whisper signals. Fine business on that. Lloyd, GW1OII, he recently purchased a copy of Experimental Methods in RF Design. Very good buy there, Lloyd. I think you'll like it. And he recommends a podcast called Linux in the Ham Shack. I'm going to have to listen to that because I need to learn more about Linux. Alpha Alpha 1 TJ, Michael, has the book. I hope you like it, Mike. And finally, another Mike, VK3XL, sent me info on an Australian song about sheds. A guy apparently liked his shed so much that he wrote a song about it, and it's out there in VK land. So thanks for sharing that with us, Mike. Guys, that's the end of Solder Smoke 109. Hope the summer's going well for you. Melt some solder, have some fun, take the book to the beach, and anyway, hope to see you again in a couple of weeks. 7-3 from Rome.